Spindle Wood survived, but Tight Knot was very vulnerable. It was cutting Forest Service timber, and if it couldn't, if it couldn't keep up its payments and its contractual obligations with the Forest Service, and you couldn't turn that into money, the manufactured lumber into money, they couldn't stay out too long. They didn't have that much reserves. And I know that everybody always planned how much they had to have in the piled up in the, what did they call that, the big log pile, the log deck. Uh-huh. And you had to cut in the summertime and in the fall in order to keep you going in the winter, because you couldn't get into those woods up there. Winters were very severe in Central Oregon, and in the early days where you'd have snow 3 and 4 feet deep in the forest, so that it wasn't possible to get in and to get the logs. And wasn't even possible even to get into our cabin. We always just drained the pipes in the fall, and once in a while, if you could, we'd get in there, but they didn't plow any of the roads. So the timber was inaccessible in the wintertime, and we'd try to walk in and build a fire in the fireplace, but with no running water, no anything, it wasn't very satisfactory. Yeah. So I wish that I had clearer recollections of the strike, except that it hit the whole town of Redmond pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And there were bitter feelings, and it took quite a long time to get them back. But once they all went back to work, they were going like gangbusters.
Mm-hmm. So
so during this time, I think that Sam was just restive, mm-hmm. at really not being in charge and having to consult with somebody that far away. And his father, you had to make an appointment to see Sam's father, even when you were right there in Berkeley. You didn't just drop in, and Sam was torn between this drop-in, informal, handshake, kind of operate out of the seat of your pants, or your back pocket, and somebody who wanted all these things signed and dotted. There were lawsuits going on all the time for various infractions of the rules, and if there weren't actually lawsuits, there were threats of lawsuits. And George Brewster, who was the leading attorney in Redmond and was the lawyer for the sawmill, Sam used to always laugh about it. He said George would sue right down to his client's last dime. But George was a pugnacious, bulldog kind of fellow who was really a very able lawyer. And a lot of the state's able jurists and judges were products of going through George Brewster's law office, but he never took any threats of a lawsuit lightly, and you found yourself in court lots of times. And then there always were the IRS with audits, and all these fellows were partners. They were not, that was not a corporation. So each of them had his own personal income tax problems. And matter of insuring each other. And it was actually after the plywood plant got started in Madras, and they all were partners up there, Phil, Harold, Sam, and they had such big obligations that they all insisted that each one be insured, so in the event of the death of one of them, there would be insurance to cover it, and you wouldn't have, that was a corporation. And that's when Sam first became aware of the fact that he had this irregular heartbeat.
Oh, really?
Because it was very difficult for him to get the kind of multi-million dollar insurance coverage that they all had to have. Because this was kind of one of their first ventures into being a corporation, okay. where one was responsible for the other, and where there had to be a succession worked out. They just really hadn't even thought about it. And Phil had two sons, but neither of his two sons seemed to be that interested in the lumber business. Sam had no sons at all. And Harold Barkley had some sons, and none of them seemed to show the same interest. So these older fellas were kind of out there by themselves, having to kind of work out some sort of a succession. But so to come back to, we're back now before Sam bought his father out. His father used to come up for hunting in the fall and always bring somebody. And they did it in great style. There were cars and people to drive the cars and dogs and all of the hunting gear and making quite a safari out of it. They hunted on somebody's ranch over at Prineville, among other places, and they fished. And his father would come back with these great catches of big trout and whatnot and killing quail. And where I came from, you know, quails were protected songbirds, and you wouldn't no more have killed a quail than risk being in jail. And you just, it was unthinkable. And so all of a sudden they'd present me with this leather thing with all these beautiful little quail bodies hanging on it, and I had to learn how to cook them. And wild duck, likewise. I remember the first time down at Sam's father's house when they came around and asked you how long you wanted your duck in the oven, and people were saying 20 minutes and 16 minutes and all that sort of thing. That was a new experience for me. We always had our ducks well cooked, well baked.
They didn't prepare their own game. They didn't clean their own game. Or did they
clean it? Well, they cleaned it pretty well, but they didn't take the feathers off. Okay. General Joyce had a wonderful recipe for quail, which he gave me, and I fixed it. It was very good, but it was something that I wasn't used to, and likewise with the trout. And as it turned out, both Sam and his father, with tendencies toward gout, shouldn't have been eating all of that that wild game anyhow, because it had purines in it, and purines translate into uric acid. And if you, gout and diabetes are systemic diseases, and they're both related. They're incurable, but they're controllable. But it's either a matter of making too much sugar or not eliminating enough of it. And with gout, it's a matter of making too much uric acid or not eliminating enough of it. And the uric acid could go into urate deposits. So they shouldn't have been eating all of that stuff. And Sam didn't like it very well anyhow. And I think partly because Sam was not a hunter. He did like to fish, but not for the fish. He turned them back very often, but it was for the thrill of catching a trout, and fly casting is all that he did, and never did the kind of plug fishing, or he didn't like deep sea fishing, and his father did. And it was again a part of a being the only son of a very powerful, very able, very dominating male figure, and not wanting to get into competition with him, and yet knowing that if he wanted to, he probably could do some of that stuff as well, but just chose not to. And so in many ways, Sam and his father had great respect for each other, but it wasn't the casual father-son relationship until after Sam bought his father out. And then because Sam did very well and the colonel wanted him to do well, they found that they had a much easier relationship, and it was just better. And Sam fully wanted to talk to his father and talk things over with him, and did. But it was on a different basis after he bought him out. And I think the colonel always knew that Sam was going to inherit his interest in the business anyway. Better he should buy it. And they should have it on a working arrangement where Sam was responsible for it, and the colonel could know that it was being done. And so it worked out fine. Then the colonel died in 1951, as it happened, very suddenly. Yeah. Anyway, so it was good that Sam was on his own.
Was it a hard moment when he approached his father with the purpose of buying out his father's interest?
I honestly don't remember that there was any, you know, that I was aware of a moment when they decided to do this. They'd been talking about it back and forth and trying to arrive at reasonable price, and the colonel obviously was not trying to wring the last dime out of Sam the way he would if he'd been selling out to somebody else. But the colonel was just glad, I think, too, to be able to concentrate in San Francisco and on his investment business, which he was in then, and on his social things. And his father always said life's not long enough to have one, just have one hunting season a year and one this season and that season a year. So he and Katie traveled a great deal, and they went to South America practically every winter, where he could do the trout fishing and all of the things that you do in the summertime, and went to Hawaii, and they were on the first clipper ship that went to Hawaii, where I guess in those days you had your car sent over on a ship, so that you'd have a car in Hawaii, and we're on this first clipper ship, and he, through lots of different connections, knew people in the top echelons of the automotive business. I constantly keep forgetting the name of the fellow in Chrysler, and Louis Johnson, who was in one of the administrations, and the people at the top of a lot of different industries, and certainly the timber industry. And I can't remember when Sam's father stopped doing the timber brokering. Mm-hmm. He continued to do that too, but not up in Central, not in Oregon.
Was his health declining?
Sam's father?
48, or were there indications?
No, his father's health seemed to be pretty good. He did the summer of the year that he died, when he went to the Bohemian Grove. A lot of people remarked that he didn't look very well, and he wasn't his usual robust self. And Sam's father was a vigorous, you know, go kind of enjoyed life a lot, and certainly enjoyed the kinds of activities that went on at the Bohemian Club. And while he wasn't the captain, he kind of was the informal leader of the group. And they just said that he looked kind of gaunt. And as I look at pictures of him now, you could see that he didn't look himself. As far as I know, he had not had any serious illness, but he had that same irregular heartbeat. Uh-huh. And the night that he died, it was sort of interesting because it was a terribly hot night in Redmond, and Sam and Betsy and I were down in our ground floor apartment, and I was making fresh blueberry muffins, I remember, and they were just about ready to come out of the oven when the colonel called. And Sam's mother too, but his father talked for over a half an hour on the telephone with Sam, and then he no more than and he'd ask about me and ask about Betsy, and it really wasn't. He liked his grandchildren, but he was no cuddly grandpa. And he asked a lot about Betsy, and then he called back and wanted to talk to me, and we talked for quite a little while, and he asked a lot about Betsy. And I remember putting Betsy on the phone. She couldn't do much at that age. She was in a high chair. But he just seemed very solicitous about everything, and I bet you that it wasn't 5 minutes after I hung up talking with him, Katie called back and said the colonel just died. Mm-hmm. He was sitting in the bar. He and she were having their usual Sunday night kind of little slice of this and slice of that. He made quite a fetish of liking things like those Virginia hams, you know, those hard things that you have to soak, and then you have to cook for a long time slowly. And I know the people at his house really hated it when they had some more of those to make, but they made wonderful sliced, very thin, on a piece of rye bread to have along with a drink. And Katie and he were just having their supper in the bar, and he just set his glass down and he just died.
Is that right?
And the doctors assured Katie afterwards that if there'd have been an army of doctors there, uh-huh, couldn't have done anything for him. It was just cardiac arrest, and that was that. And so then when she called, there wasn't any way for us to get down to San Francisco directly. So we got somebody to look after Betsy, and we flew down to Klamath Falls and took a train, overnight train down. And I remember it was starting to get dark as we were flying down there, and Sam did not have night flying ratings. He had a private pilot's license, and he was really kind of uneasy flying, particularly after there got to be more airplanes in the Portland area. But these fellas all flew, all of them, and so he just had to do it. And they took my first car that Sam got for me was a blue Packard, and that had ended up in Troutdale, and the poor thing sat outside, and it would get mildew and musty and rusty, and but whoever flew in, then they'd land in Troutdale, then could drive the car into town. And very often the weather would be such on the Portland area that they couldn't get the car back, and so the airplane back, so they drive back. And I hated to see my nice car go to pieces, but that's the way it was. And so Sam just never got all those ratings. He had enough that he could fly, but it was strictly white knuckle kind of stuff. And I was especially apprehensive, and so was Sam, watching the sun go down over the mountains there, and knowing we had to land at Klamath Falls, and he didn't land there all that often. Uh-huh. But we'd made it, and yeah, it was fine. It was a midnight train that we took down. And so for Sam's mother, losing the colonel so suddenly, and having their whole life tied up together, and I don't know how many years they'd been married. Actually, you never could tell when their anniversary was, because Katie was older than the colonel was, and she was very, very careful that you didn't see her date. Mm-hmm. She just said she was over 21 on her driver's license, and so on. And they were married the first time by a justice of the peace, because of the very strong religious convictions of Sam's grandmother, and Sam's father was not Catholic either, and they just got married then. And then Katie didn't feel right until she was married by a Catholic priest. So they were married another time by a priest, and then the grandmother wasn't happy until they were married in the Episcopal Church. So they had three separate kind of anniversaries. But at any rate, they'd been quite a team together, and it was, for Katie, just a tough adjustment, because all of the children, of course, were grown, and the one daughter lived in grandmother's house at that time, so those two grandchildren were right next door. But she was getting ready to move to Menlo Park or Atherton, one of those places. And her husband had belonged to one of the old San Francisco Italian families. Their last name was Musto, and they were in the marble and granite business from Italy. And Joe just felt it was better to live a little ways away and Kathleen did too, away from grandparents. And so they had bought their house. So Katie kept the same staff on. There was a driver. The colonel always had somebody drive the car, so he didn't have to find a parking place in San Francisco. And that fellow doubled as a kind of a gardener too. And then there was a cook. And then there was a German maid that had been with them from the time the children were little, and she had never married, and that was home for her. And Sam was terribly fond of her. Her name was Bertha. And when our children came along, Bertha was just entranced by them. Actually, she didn't ever know Patty, but she did know Betsy, and spoiled her just rotten when we'd go down there to San Francisco. But Katie kept all these people on.
She may have felt like a grandmother.
She sort of did. The Johnsons were her family. And actually, Sam's father had, and Bertha Skellinger, who had been the secretary for a long time, made investments for Bertha. Sam's father would give her shares of stock. And so she had kind of a nice little nest egg and security for herself. And when Katie sold the house and moved to San Francisco, to a big old apartment on the corner of Hyde and Lombard Street, that twisty, turny street. I remember going with her to look at apartments and thinking of her furniture and the size of a lot of that furniture that had been in those big old rooms that had high ceilings, and they were heavy. And in those days, lots of mohair and kind of brocaded sort of furniture. Katie couldn't see squeezing that in lot of those apartments, and especially where you didn't have a separate dining room. She couldn't think of life without a separate dining room, because entertaining was one of the things that Sam's mother and father did constantly. And there were comings and goings for dinner parties.
Did
back and forth,
that life,
and she continued that to a large extent. I remember Bertha died very suddenly. Well, she didn't die suddenly, but she had a stroke. Katie came back from Mass one Sunday morning and found Bertha in the kitchen of the San Francisco apartment, and it was obvious that she had had a stroke. So Katie got her immediately to a hospital, and she lived, but she couldn't ever resume working again, and so she was moved to a long-term care place, and she must have lived for 5 or 6 months after that. But at any rate, she had gone back to Germany several times and had been reunited with her family. And one of her nieces had had a child and without a father. And that was a terrible disgrace in Germany. And Bertha was so fond of that child, whom she just called the little one. Mm-hmm. And so Sam was the executor of her affairs, and she wanted, quote, the little one to have whatever she had, which was very nice. And Bertha was just a lovely, warm, wonderful German lady who never learned to speak English all that well. And you can imagine, with a Chinese cook in the kitchen and a German housemaid who ran the butler's pantry and did all of the table setting and the serving and so forth, it was almost open warfare in the kitchen. And so that the Chinese man lived in an apartment above the garage, and Bertha lived in the house. Always very modest room and everything, but she had her friends and belonged to one of those German-American clubs in Oakland. And so from one point of view, you could say, my, that wasn't much of a life for Bertha. On the other hand, she always said, what more could I ask for? And so when Katie went to San Francisco, that particular cook, and the colonel always took the Chinese cook from the house to the Bohemian Grove in the summertime, so the Chinese cook cooked for these fellas. He didn't want to go to San Francisco, and Katie didn't want him to go either. He, by this time, gotten to be pretty crotchety. Mm-hmm. And the colonel and Katie had helped bring some of his Chinese relatives to the United States and so forth. They didn't expect any reciprocity from him, but he was a wonderful cook. But when he elected not to go to San Francisco, that was fine with Katie. And Katie had Sam's sister Kathleen had been in England, and her husband, and with some other people, and she'd seen an ad in the London papers for somebody who wanted to come to the United States, but she wanted to be an upstairs maid. And by this time, people didn't have upstairs maids in the United States. But Kathleen interviewed this German girl and her German friend, and they had escaped from East Germany. And they were just anxious to get to the United States, and each of them had to have a job. So Kathleen promised her, this was a girl by the name of Hildegard, promised her the job, knowing very well that Kay wasn't going to employ her. But she arrived in the United States just about the time that Bertha was in the long-term care place and was just living at Katie's house, and in exchange for that was fixing breakfast. One thing that I always laughed about, that I didn't ever have to hear from Sam, that's not the way Mother made it, because Katie didn't cook, and Sam kidded her often about, Katie, you'd have to just be used to scrambled eggs 3 times a day and a cup of tea, because that's about what you do. It was just because Katie didn't really take to it, and she did lots of other things, and cooking was not one of them. And I remember before Sam and I were married, we were in somebody's house here in Portland, and we were out in the kitchen. It was a beautiful kitchen, and I commented about it, and Sam said, well, that's fine. I appreciate the fact that you like kitchens, but I can just tell you one thing, that I hope you're never in one, because I'm not comfortable in kitchens. I don't cook, and I do like to have food. I do like to have people having a gemütlich kind of a drink ahead of time. And so if you have thoughts about being in the kitchen, kind of start disengaging from that. And that's the way it worked out. Always on the weekends, though, you know, we cooked. But we had, fortunately, after we moved into the bigger house and after Betsy was born, I did all the cooking in the little house, and he would join me. He was a pretty good sport about it. It wasn't anything that was a rubbing point between us, but he just plain didn't want to do the cooking. But he did when we were just the two of us. And we ate very irregularly. But at any rate, Hildegard came on just at the right time, and she became then. Uh-huh. And this was another German girl, and she was with Sam's mother for those years, became the driver and the general factotum and good company, and was younger, and Katie and she got along just beautifully. Okay. She was with Katie when she died.
Yeah, that's very fortunate.
Yes, you bet it was. Wonderful.
I wanted to move the scene to your involvements, your public involvements.
Yeah.
But I would like to start, I'd like to move toward Board of Education and so forth.
Right.
Toward your political interests. But I would like to, I think it would be a good idea to start in the town of Redmond and what it was like dealing with, getting to know, associating with the local people, because I have the impression from what I've looked at that you started on a sort of local basis in your public involvements with education schools, and I wonder if we could get into it in that way.
Well, I spent a great deal of time alone because Sam and Phil and Harold were off, you know, looking at equipment and looking at timber sales, and they were always speculating about maybe extending their holdings to some other part of the state, and so off they'd go, and sometimes I went with him and sometimes I didn't, but I got interested in gardening. My mother had been a tremendous gardener, and all my life I had not done any of it myself, and this first little house we had a nice yard, and so I started doing all of the outside yard work, and then I was invited to join the Oregon Republican Women's Organization that Mrs. Gerlinger had, and we met at a house up on South Canyon Drive that was owned by a Mrs. Lynch, and she was the Mrs. Lynch of Lynch and Roberts, and I also got acquainted with Orpha Cunning, who was the wife of the local attorney. Those ladies had mostly come from Iowa or from Nebraska, and Orpha was a musician, she was a harpist, and interested in literary things, and slowly but surely I was asked to join the Juniper Literary Club, which was very typical of a lot of clubs that were started in these small towns. There was even some in Portland too, by people who came from the East who found a lack of music and art and theater, and there was only radio, and in Redmond in those days it was almost impossible to get radio there. There was one station in Bend, and at night the dial would be so crowded with stations you couldn't sort them out, and in the daytime almost nothing to listen to. So I joined the Juniper Literary Club, and then it was after Betsy and Patty were both born. I know I belonged to the Juniper Literary Club, and the first paper I gave was on Susan B. Anthony, and I did a great deal of research on her, and it was very interesting. And that my mother was kind of one of those early suffragette people that believed in women having the right to vote and was terribly frustrated when you couldn't. So I just took naturally, I think, to being interested in that sort of thing. But then I was invited to play bridge, and I didn't play bridge all that well. And they started duplicate bridge sessions. And I never did get very good at duplicate bridge, but there was a man who wrote a